Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. A new book by rock critic Bob Mayer takes on the story of The Replacements. The book is called Trouble Boys, and it tells a story of the Minneapolis-based rock band and their rise and fall in the 80s and early 90s. But it's more than a VH1 behind the music. This is a 400-page, in-depth look at one of the most fascinating bands of our time. It's not a feel-good story, as it's littered with missed opportunities and tales of abuse, addiction, and destruction. Bob Mayer is a music critic who writes for the Memphis newspaper, The Commercial Appeal, and he's going to be on stage tomorrow being interviewed by MTV's Jessica Hopper at The Hideout. That's at 3 o'clock. Bob Mayer, welcome to The Download.
Thank you for having me.
I kind of tongue-in-cheek say this isn't a VH1's behind the music because it's more than just the sort of rise and fall of this rock band. This is a research project. This is a rock book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I started out not knowing that was going to be the case necessarily. I thought I was going to just tell the story of a rock band, a colorful rock band, an interesting one. But as it turned out, once I started doing the research, and it was one of those things where I thought it's going to take 2 years that ended up taking closer to about seven, as I got deeper into the story, I realized this was much more than a story of a rock and roll band. It was that, but it was also a story of abuse, addiction, as you say. It's a family story. It's a story about Midwestern families and people who came from environments steeped in alcoholism and repression, I suppose, sort of Catholic blue-collar roots, and how all those forces kind of shaped who these guys were and shaped their desperation in a sense to form the band and how all that ended up sort of carrying them through most of the 1980s.
It's said in the book, you know, the Replacements are legends but not stars.
That was the case, and I think, you know, one of the things that the book is about focuses on is about their struggle to achieve a kind of commercial success at a time when bands, and they were one of the first really alternative bands signed to a major label during that time, it was still a lab experiment. You know, this is in the pre-Nirvana era. Rock radio was still very much, even though it was the 80s, it was still very much a kind of 70s model.
Yeah.
And marketing bands was still very much done that way. And they were not a video-friendly band. You know, they didn't like the idea of videos, which was the then burgeoning sort of new wave of marketing groups. And so I think they had a lot of things going against them. They had a lot of things that they sort of weren't comfortable doing. So the story becomes about this struggle to find their place within the business and the industry. And it is a weird thing is when they broke up in 1991, that was almost the start of a second life for them.
Yeah.
And they became, within a few short years and have continued to, they became kind of these legends, as you say, without being stars.
Yeah, it's amazing to me because as a kid myself, I mean, I think back to 1993, 1994, when it was like the heyday, grab every piece of alternative rock music
right.
you could. There was this search that I really feel was about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to the Replacements.
Right.
The Replacements over and over became the band that everybody knew, even though they weren't getting played on the radio or they weren't. WXRT here in town
sure.
played them, but they weren't on the Billboard charts. But there was something about the fact that this was as pure of a rock band, an alternative rock band, you were going to get.
And that's part of what kept them interesting. Paul Westerberg, the lead singer and songwriter, talks about that in the book. When I asked him at one point during the many years and many visits to his house, I said, you know, what if you guys had that one hit, you know, the thing that broke through and made it onto the charts and was a kind of success that you were known for. And he looked at me honestly and he said, you wouldn't be here. And so the fact that they fell short, that they're kind of ensconced in this idea of the beautiful loser, of the band that almost made it, that kept them pure and I think added to their legend and their myth and helped him. You know, I think if they'd, like I say, if they had that hit, it would have taken something away. I mean, they still would have had the great songs. They still would have had the thing, but in a weird way, their failure became a kind of success.
And it's weird as a fan to think that none of those songs were quote unquote hits.
No,
when
I mean,
you think of Can't Hardly Wait, you think right. of any of the songs that are radio friendly, and they're there, and you're like, these are in my brain when it's wired in. You're like, oh, the huge hit that was Can't Hardly Wait with the Replacements, but it wasn't.
Yeah, and the closest they really ever got to the top 40 was with a song called I'll Be You, which was on their sort of big polished major label album Don't Tell a Soul in '89, and that got up to maybe 51 on the chart. And that record, you know, they never went gold. They never had a top 40 hit. And yet there's so much more lionized and talked about than so many bands who did have hits. So in a weird way, in a funny way, it's kind of they had their victory wasn't for that one moment during their career, but their victory kind of became one for all time.
You know, another thing I love about this is that, you know, you do get into the family life of the band. And there's some tragic stuff with the Stinson brothers and
right.
and in Westerberg himself. But there's a lot of stories about how they came up with abuse and
right.
alcoholic parents and all the way through. And it's almost like, and I was sort of talking to Pete about this, it almost feels like, you know, rock and roll saved their lives.
That's true. It's for me, it is a story of these kids, what happens to these kids who come from these damaged American families, Midwestern families, how they deal with that damage, and they find a kind of salvation in rock and roll, and it becomes like this thing that saves them. But it only saves them for so long
right.
and for so far. And the things catch up with him. It certainly caught up with Bob Stinson, who was kind of subject to most of the abuse. He was eventually kicked out of the band, died young at age 35. It caught up with Westerberg to a certain extent in terms of him having to deal with his drinking at the end of the band. And it really caught up with the band in a sense. I mean, the band kind of collapsed amid some of the same issues that brought them
That's
together.
The terrible beauty of this story is that rock and roll saved their lives and ultimately killed them.
Right. Yeah.
I mean that's kind of what happened. The things that they were that rock and roll saved, they were the things that didn't get them to move to the next level.
To the next level. Yeah. I mean, and that's but I think it's also that the truth and the power of their experiences that has made them resonate for so long and so deeply for so many people. I think people sensed, even, you know, before this book was written, they didn't know these things about their backgrounds. But I think people sensed on a kind of gut level that there was something powerful and painful and you know, emotional behind those songs mm-hmm. and behind those performances. And they connected with that. And I think that's why they've continued to mean so much to successive generations. You know, they have fans that are, you know, people who saw them at the time who were in their mid-50s, and they have fans who are 18, 19, 20 who are still sort of discovering them.
What I love about the Replacements, and it's in this book as well, is their issues with consistency.
Right.
You know, they would be able to go up on stage and do a rock show for the ages, and then turn around the next day and have the big sloppy piece of chaos. Well,
or vice versa. You know, the first night might be bad, the second night might be genius. That is kind of the thing. I mean, some of that was, you know, in some ways a lot of. And so much of their reputation is built on their live performance, these covers, heavy sets, these drunken sets, these wild, amazing shows, and the clunkers, the stinkers in the midst, which were a kind of comedy and drama in themselves. But, you know, some of that was natural. The things that Westerberg talked about is like, we didn't go on and fake it. We played our mood. If we were bored, we played bored. If we were excited, if we were challenged by the audience, you know, they reacted to what was in front of them and what the mood was at the moment. And I think, yeah, that doesn't always breed consistency, but it breeds a lot of memories for people. And I think the funny and maybe the ironic thing, in some ways, people talk more about the bad shows than the good ones, which is unfortunate because there was a lot more good shows than bad ones.
Right.
But, you know, that's sort of the
lore.
Yeah, that's right. The lore in a way. And you know, some of that was calculated, I think. The things they did on stage, as natural as they were, as instinctive as they were, I think as a band they also had a sense of showmanship to do little things that would, you know, lodge in people's brains, and they're still talking about them 30 years later.
Well, I mean, that's a good rock and roll band. I mean, even the bands that, you know, we've talked about, we had Rich Cohen in here talking about the Rolling Stones.
Right.
I mean, another band that, you know, imploded at some point.
Sure.
But that's, you know, they got it together to go, this is a business. You know, we have to take this, we have to be professional, we have to figure this out. It's almost the story of the Replacements until the Replacements just didn't figure it out. Mm-hmm.
Well, I saw the Stones. I remember seeing them here when I was living in Chicago and reviewed a show. They did two nights at the United Center. It's like, I remember them fumbling Satisfaction. They've been playing that for 40 years. So you get, you know, I think the really great bands, and I certainly the Replacements and the Rolling Stones have a lot of common elements in terms of their approach to playing. You know, the magic is mingled in with the mayhem. So that's kind of how it goes.
Another thing about the band, the Replacements, is it really, and you kind of pull this out, you know, in the summary of the book, but just the concept that this is one of the first indie rock bands that signs to a major label.
Right.
And we've heard that story. We've, you know, we've been force-fed that story for a long time about indie rock and major labels. Talk about that and the replacement sort of being the first.
Yeah, I mean, they were among the groups in this era of, you know, post-punk America, late 70s into the early 80s, and there was this kind of rebirth of independent music in America. Certainly in the 50s, labels like Chess were independents, but this was a different kind of era. And they were the first band really to be signed by Warner Brothers, a very progressive, artist-friendly label at the time, and Sire. And they were kind of guinea pigs in the way for how alternative music was marketed and sold.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of wouldn't be realized until a few years later with Nirvana, where it kind of...
Almost like they treated them like a rock band from the late 70s kind of thing. And so very different kind of approach.
Westenberg says it in the book, too. He says, you know, we were 10 years behind or 5 years ahead. And it's true. You could almost see them fitting in with bands like The Faces or Mott the Hoople or groups like that from the early 70s, from like 10 years earlier. And you could also see them having been more commercially successful if they'd have come 5 years later in the 93, 94, when alternative radio was a much greater force. And so I think, you know, it's kind of being a band out of time in a sense. And you know, they suffered for that in the moment, but as I say, I think their greater legacy and their greater success would come, you know, in the decades that would follow.
Paul Westerberg plays obviously being able to get him to talk.
Right.
He's sort of famously reclusive, quiet. And
right.
You talk about his upbringing. That's his family. That's where it comes from. But you know, Pete and I were talking about a nice little hour long combo about about the book. But you know, did the Replacements essentially have more trouble because of Paul Westerberg's personality, meaning he wasn't a Mick Jagger.
Right.
He wasn't this sort of, oh, the cameras are here. Oh, the mics are on. I'll talk to anybody. I mean, he's reclusive. He hid.
During that era, it's funny, he was comfortable with writers, I think, because he's a writer. He was not comfortable with the other aspects of the business, you know, with TV,
the
wine and dine,
right.
Labels, that kind of thing. And I think that comes from a kind of fear of success, fear of failure. It's the Replacements were a band that was sort of governed by fear in a lot of ways. There are different fears. And I think, you know, in some ways, Tommy Stinson, who was kind of the heart and the face of the band, he would have been better suited to have been that front person. He later went on to a very successful career for many years playing with Guns N' Roses. I mean, he was kind of to the manor born. He was a born performer. He was on stage by the time he was 11. He quit high school at 15, was on the road. I mean, he was the natural rock and roller. For Westerberg, I think he was a writer who became a rock and roller because that was the only means to express himself at that time. So, yeah, I mean, there's ways you can see where Paul's personality and certainly the band took their cues from him where that hurt or impacted their career adversely. But, you know, it's one of those things where the Replacements is such a delicate and special thing, sort of the alchemy of the four of them. It had to be the way it was to turn out that way.
I mean, the chemistry of the four together, I mean, they stumbled around to find that.
Right.
But they really didn't have as much success independently, even Tommy working with Guns N' Roses and Paul Westerberg's solo career.
Yeah.
But they never were able to find the chemistry they had when working together.
I think those powerful things that you have as a young man that you find with this group, and as Paul said, you know, they were governed by their limitations. You know, Paul says in the book there wasn't a high school diploma or a driver's license between them, and that's true. Like literally, none of them could drive. None of them had graduated from high school. So I think that breeds a certain kind of desperation, and that's what brought Paul and Bob, you know, together and kind of created that first bond, and then later as the band continued on, that bond kind of shifted between them and went to Paul and Tommy. And of course, Chris Marrs was kind of like, you know, if everybody's fire and ice, he's the lukewarm water in between. So yeah, these dynamics shift and change. And I think the idea of the Replacements was ultimately consistent. It was this thing of like, even without Bob in the band and he left sort of midway through, they still carried on that thing. But I think once it was done in 91, they never quite recaptured that spark. And I just don't think there's any way to do that because, you know, that's a once in a lifetime thing. And when they reunited eventually in 2013 and did these shows, including a, you know, big show at Riot Fest here in Chicago, it really was a thing of like, they're playing those songs and it's just Paul and Tommy at this point, but even just the two of them, they still had that magic that moved people. So
and still the same issues that made them implode.
Right, yeah, right,
the same
too,
issues.
Right.
You know, Chicago does play a role in the replacement story. There was the infamous Taste of Chicago
right, which
show,
was
which was their
show.
Final show. I mean, they broke up off stage, right?
Yeah, they handed off their instruments to the roadies and walked off stage, and that was it, a kind of symbolic handing off. And then, of course, they reunited. The second show they played in their reunion in 2013 was at a park as well here in Chicago. So, and even early on, I mean, some of their first shows they did outside of the immediate, you know, Minneapolis, Wisconsin area were in Chicago playing with Husker Du and like the song Kids Don't Follow, which is the first song off their second album, Stink, and this very iconic song that was written kind of here in Chicago and performed for the first time here. So, yeah, Chicago, the upper Midwest, you know, figures very prominently in the replacement story and certainly the Windy City, maybe more than almost any other city.
For you as a music critic, I mean, you have so many different things you have to write. I mean, that's your job. You're
sure.
A writer. You write about different bands. To be able to put a project like this together, do you feel almost like a kindred connection to the Replacements now? Do you feel like what's your thought about the band after this being done and now you're starting to go on the circuit? Like, where's your heart at when it comes to the Replacements?
Well, I think for me, and you know, because I'm uncovering a lot of truths about the band, and it wasn't my intention I didn't set out to demythologize them in any way. I think maybe in some ways I add to the mythology, but I wanted to tell a true story, a real story, a human story. And when you do that and you do it for as long as I have and you come to know the people involved, not just the band but their families, it becomes a really serious and emotional process for me, certainly when you're talking about abuse and some of the things they went through and people recounting memories,
right.
You know, for me, a relative stranger that they hadn't even talked about amongst themselves. So it was a very intense experience, more than probably I expected or was even prepared for. So in some ways, I feel like I don't want to say I'm part of the story, but it's certainly I feel like I've said my part about it, and it's part of the bigger record now. So yeah, I mean, I feel an attachment to them, and I feel a greater admiration now. I think some people walk away from the book feeling like, oh man, I almost wish I hadn't read that. I didn't want to know all this, but. You know, but I think in the same breath they'll also say, but I'm glad you did it,
right.
You know. And that's how I feel about it. It's like, yeah, it was a harrowing experience for me to go through this and to try and write this in a challenge. But at the end of the day, I'm really proud with the way it came out because I think it tells an important human story as well as a rock and roll story.
Well, personally, I want to go home and listen to all the Replacement records I can.
Well, hopefully that's what it does for everybody.
That would be the ultimate,
yeah, you know.
Yeah. The book is called Trouble Boys. It's the true story of the Replacements. The author is Bob Mayer. He writes for the Commercial Appeal in Memphis. Also worked here at The Reader back in the mid-2000s.
Yep.
Bob, thanks for being my guest, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.